The Contenders is a proud member of the Cage Club Podcast Network.
For other great shows about movies and pop culture, go visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
I have waited to do this for so long.
No, no, whoa, get up, get up. Dad, you're supposed to knock.
Wow, high school students are looking rougher and rougher these days. Who are you?
It's kind of hard to explain.
Hey, did you hear the one about the grown woman who started hanging out with a bunch of pubescent kids?
No, what?
No, I'd never heard of it before either.
Welcome to The Contenders, the show about the movies made by and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. I am Tobin Addington.
And I'm Aislinn Addington.
And today we are joined by yet another very special guest. We've got Corey O'Connell with us. Hi, Corey.
Hello. Great to be here.
We go way back, but Aislinn doesn't know you very well, and neither do maybe to some of our listeners. Would you give us a little like, what are you up to? What are you doing these days? Who are you?
Who am I? Right now, I'm a film student. I'm a graduate MFA student at the Feirstein Graduate School of Cinema at Brooklyn College, studying screenwriting, and also in my abundant spare time, working as a nonprofit database consultant. Which,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it is what it is, and that's why I'm back in grad school.
At one point in time, you had thought about becoming a critic or a film scholar moved into screenwriting, right?
I did. I just liked your screenwriting classes so much that I had to go back to it.
Wow. This is why you invite people on.
Yes, exactly. It's all about an ego boost for me.
I know.
Yes.
How's that ego?
I did try a film studies MA program, and I did participate in the New York Film Festival's Critics Academy, and that is what made me realize also that I would rather be working to make films rather than writing about them.
Today, we're going to talk about Leggies from 2014, and I have a hard time saying that word and people hearing what I'm saying. I'm saying L-A-G-G-I-E-S, and it was about 5 minutes on the phone with our mother today before we got that down, because she was hearing L-E-G-G-I-E-S.
Uh-huh.
So, a little bit different. Apologies. It's an awkward one. Not the film. Well, it is, but the
pronunciation of the title.
And this is a film that I rented on Netflix when I still got discs from Netflix.
Oh, wow.
Wow. So I'm going to say I saw it 2015. I mean, I saw it not in the theater when it came out, but when it was available to me in my home. I picked it up pretty quickly based on, I think, an article and a trailer. So this was the second time I'd seen it. What about you all? Were you familiar with this movie?
I was very familiar with this movie. I read about it when it was premiered at Sundance, and I was like, this sounds like something that I really need to see. And when it came out, I saw it in theaters down at the AMC in East Village, and it was $17 and worth every penny, so much so that I actually went back and saw it a second time a few weeks later, which I never do for New York ticket prices, but I just enjoyed it that much. So this was, bought it on DVD, I pre-ordered it online, and also had a copy sent to my best friend because I was just like, I was like, you really need to see this. And I know you're not going to rent it, so I'm sending it to you.
That's dedication. I appreciate that.
That's amazing. I love that. I love that. That whole story. That's great. I had never seen this movie before. I was aware of it, and I know Lynn Shelton. I've seen, I guess maybe not all of her other movies, but a number of them. And I knew of this movie when it came out. But boy, this to my memory, disappeared from the theater pretty quickly, which is kind of a shame. I guess, Corey, you couldn't buy enough tickets to keep it in theaters long enough for me to get to it.
But you did your part, clearly.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Despite your best efforts. Yeah. I was excited to get a chance to check it out. Aizen, I think this is one you put on the list.
It was indeed. And I'm looking forward to our conversation because I experienced it very differently this time around than I did 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. So I'm excited. But before we actually get to talk about it, we have more preamble. Toby, could you give us a little bit of history? Could you give us 2 bits about this film?
Yeah, here are my 2 bits. And maybe Corey has more to add since she is more familiar with this film. The first is that Anne Hathaway was apparently like up to the point of about to shoot the film, going to be the lead in it. And then the schedule for Interstellar kept her out of this movie. So my one question I have is, what do you guys think about that? Would that, can you imagine this movie with Anne Hathaway in the lead?
No. Flatly no. Not gonna pretend. I mean, I was listening to your Ocean's 8 episode the other day, and I was like, yeah, I see Anne Hathaway on screen in a movie now, and she's still Anne Hathaway. And so I don't think I would have been able to accept her in the kind of role of being the confused 20-something, because I would have been like, you're Anne Hathaway, you're not confused right now, you're just you.
I
agree for similar reasons. I think, hold on, how can I craft this? A strength of this movie is allowing and perhaps celebrating someone's unlikable qualities. And so in that sense, I think Anne Hathaway could have really, really sort of exacerbated that.
That's as backhanded a compliment as they come. Yeah.
In the way that, as we've talked about before, Bill Paxton, rest in peace, was great in Big Love.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
Because I came in, with feelings. So yeah, I agree. It would have been a different film, and I would have had a hard time. To me, it would then have felt more like an Anne Hathaway movie than, a week in the life of this, confused Megan. So I think it turned out better this way.
Yeah, I think Anne Hathaway has a way of sometimes wearing her quirks a little more artificially than perhaps. I think she would have gone into quirk in this movie, maybe a little
maybe
much.
They come off potentially artificial.
Artificial? Yeah, yeah.
I sometimes regret being in this anti Anne Hathaway camp that I'm in. But for me, it is it's sincere. I don't know how else to say it. I'm just not a fan. Yeah. I am a fan of Lynn Shelton. So
yeah. So second bit, I should do the second bit.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so this is the first movie, as I understand it, that Lynn Shelton directed that she didn't also write. And it came at an interesting time in her career where she moved into directing a lot of TV did a number of episodes on a bunch of sort of well-known shows that you can kind of imagine her style meshing well with. So I'm just going to name a few of the shows that she directed a bunch of episodes of. The New Girl, Mindy Project, Master of None, Casual, Fresh Off the Boat, Love, and Glow. So those movies probably brought her directing to, I mean, didn't probably, for sure, brought her directing to more eyes than any of her movies had prior to this. And she talked a lot about that with her most recent movie called Outside In, starring Edie Falco, which got very good reviews. I didn't see it, but apparently Edie Falco has just a wonderful performance in it. And she talked, Lynn Shelton's talked a lot about how she was maybe a little bit burnt out on movies or maybe having a hard time getting movies she wanted to made until she sort of moved into this sort of TV boot camp for a while. So those are the 2 bits.
Yeah, I did know that this was the first movie that she directed, having not written it. She said she'd written a lot of well-written scripts before, but this was one of the first that she really just felt connected with. And she really considers the movie to be a collaboration of her voice and of the screenwriters, Andrea Siegel. One interesting thing that I found that is definitely Lynn's stamp on the script is that originally the whole movie was set in Orange County around Los Angeles.
Oh.
And she's from Seattle and wanted to, it's very important to her to make movies in Seattle, to use local actors, local crew. And so she asked the screenwriter, you know, would it be all right if we changed the location? And the screenwriter was very amenable to it. And so they moved it.
I'm so glad. This movie would have been much different. It would have hit me different if it had been an Orange County movie as opposed to a Seattle movie. I think that was a smart, smart choice.
It does. It makes a little more sense to me that it was originally Orange County, though.
Interesting.
I feel like that. I see that. I also, you know, I love anything Northwest shout out. So I agree that it was, I think, a good solid choice to do that. Although my joke is, yes, that local Seattle actress, Keira Knightley. I mean, this is really sort of set up, it seems like, for me also, in that of the shows you just listed, I have watched most of all of them. With a couple that I think Casual is one of the best shows that's out right now, and that people, it's on Hulu, and so not that people aren't watching, but maybe have a harder time finding. So good. I love, and every time when I see these shows, and I always look at who's directing each episode.
Good for you.
And I often point it out in my household, like, oh, this is a whatever. Or you can see in the show, like rewatching a show like The Office or something, where as the seasons go on, people get producer credits, and then people start directing episodes. And so I always point that out. Sorry, there was suddenly dog noises in my house. luckily, they were my dogs, so it was fine. But so I always, in my, you know, in my head or out loud, do a little "Oh yay, Lynn" episode.
Yeah, good,
it's a Lynn
good.
Episode. So love that. Anyway,
Nice.
And last thing, I think love is similar in that some of those characters I cannot stand. Like, they are terrible people, but and profoundly unlikable. And in relationships that I don't believe in, but I enjoy watching the show. And so I think that I give Lynn credit for some of that, whether
sure.
she's involved in it or not. But speaking of giving Lynn and others credit,
yes,
let's say some names out loud.
Okay, let's do it. Aislinn, who are the women in major roles in this movie?
Director, Lynn Shelton. Writer, Andrea Siegel. Lead roles, Keira Knightley and Chloe Grace Moretz. Producers
Here
include Lacey Leavitt, Alex Madigan, Jennifer Roth, Rosalie Swedlin, Peggy Taylor, Lisa Wilson, and Mel Elson.
Woo.
Apologies to any of those people whose names I have mispronounced. Tobin, before we go any further.
Yes.
Let's share with people what this film is about.
Okay, so this is adapted from, I think, the IMDb synopsis. In Leagues, Meg, played by Keira Knightley, is deep in the throes of a quarter-life crisis that comes to a head when she reluctantly accepts her boyfriend's marriage proposal. She escapes her life for a week, hiding out the house of her new friend, 16-year-old Annika, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, and her world-weary single dad, played by Sam Rockwell. That is Annika's dad, not Keira Knightley's dad. But it turns out you can't outrun your problems, and Meg must eventually untangle her life and finally make a decision about what really matters and how she wants to live.
Okay.
You sound skeptical. Are you skeptical of the film or of my adapted synopsis?
I guess the adapted synopsis, but I'm okay with it.
Okay. All right.
I don't know.
You sound profoundly
know.
Skeptical.
I guess I am. I guess I just became profoundly skeptical. Apologies.
That's all right. Do you want to elaborate on that or go somewhere else?
I guess go somewhere else.
Okay.
Is it the tagline for the movie that's a comedy about acting your age and other adult decisions?
Yes.
Okay, because I read that somewhere.
I think so. It's on the DVD case.
My first comment, I think, is about the directing. Again, you two are the experts, so tell me. But the sort of pre-credit sequence is a fuzzy prom after prom scene where we're really hearing more than we're seeing, mm-hmm. but it's these four women and their dates kind of around, and they're just having a blast for prom together. I immediately mm-hmm. get that this is a crew. And then, you know, sort of next, immediately is this tension between Ellie Kemper, who I think did great in mm-hmm. this role, because mm-hmm. it was before,
yeah, she did.
Before some of the other things, but it's just, it's a different, you know, it's a different shade of Ellie, and I loved it so much. But I immediately identified with that thing of when, whether you're growing apart or just having some other kind of conflict, then everything that person does is going to rub you the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Where otherwise, all those little things wouldn't matter, but they right. just matter so much because there's just such tension. And I thought that was not even built, because we didn't see the 10 years, but just sort of, we were immediately set into that. Mm-hmm. And it just, for me, flew off the screen. So of course, some of it is the portrayals too, but I felt like that was a directing success.
I think it was partially the directing, the performances, but I think that it was also definitely in the writing. Mm. And I do think a lot of it is more subtle, I think, in the sense that it's not necessarily the things that they say, but kind of how they say them. It's how one person, you know, Allison will say something, the Ellie Kemper character, and the other two women will gush over what she's saying. Mm-hmm. And Megan will sit there looking at her as though she's insane mm-hmm. and as if she thinks she should be laughing, but doesn't find it funny. And I think they do a really good job of setting up sort of different scenarios from the very beginning, in which their attitudes about certain events, about whatever events in their life, like Allison's bachelorette party, mm-hmm. How you see immediately that these women aren't all in the same place. They aren't the girls that they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree. And I think we see a lot in the first few scenes of Megan's reaction to things mm-hmm. not fitting kind of the rest of the audience, meaning the other people involved. So like the first dance, right? Yes. And the friends and the family, mm-hmm. you know, are finding it so charming, and she just can't even with it. And that happens to me in my life a lot.
Same.
So I absolutely identified with that. And not that I thought the other friends or the people who did find it charming were stupid. I'm fine with them finding it charming and just like looking around to get that cue of what am I supposed to think of all this?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that? Oh goodness. That's mm-hmm. not what I took from it. And so I think that's a nice, those examples kind of get sewn together to give us a picture of, like you say, that Meg is not in the same place, you know, internally as these other people around her that maybe she once was in line with them.
Hmm. Yeah. Something that Ellie Kemper said that was about her character, Allison, that I found really interesting is that she said she herself is not a bad person overall, but I think that Allison is clinging to this idea that things should not change as you go from childhood to teen years to adult. Mm. And sometimes things do change and you have to allow room for that. And I think she's scared of allowing room for that. Yeah. And she said that, and I was like, this is why you played this character so well, right. because you really understood that about her.
Absolutely. Right. I think that came across great, because I never thought that she was a bad person. I think anytime you drop into someone right when they're having a large life event, mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to get, you know, we got Wedding Allison, which might right. be different than the rest. So I agree with Ellie that Allison's probably a great person.
Yeah.
Despite her nitpicking.
usually all of her nitpicking and everything that she's doing, trying to control the events around her, comes from this desire to have similar experiences with her friends and share in those experiences with them. So every time when she pops in to say, "Oh, Savannah, you asked Megan and Anthony to be your baby's godparents." She knew about it already because she probably had a hand in that. The same way she had a hand in helping Anthony pick out the ring that he was going to propose with, and in giving him permission to propose to Megan at her own wedding.
Right.
Yes. And if they were all, sort of truly on the same page, none of those things would necessarily sort of slap us in the face the way they do. But the at that brunch from hell, when they're asking Megan and Anthony to be godparents, and then Allison just whoop is right there, literally comes into frame, as if ready, like, oh yes, I'm a part of this too. Like, we're all, like you say, it's her thing. We're all doing these things together. We're all supposed to do these things together. Mm-hmm. We're all supposed to do these things. And
the thing that I thought of as we see the different way that Meg is sort of experiencing these things is there was a time when I think maybe I was in high school and then in college, and Aislinn and I for a while could not go or sit near each other at events.
True story.
Because we would be at either family or, like, I remember there was like a National Honor Society induction or whatever.
That
we could not be even within eye shot of one another because we just look at each other and crack up because it felt like various things that were going around us were ludicrous, and that we were maybe the only sane ones or maybe the only insane ones in attendance. And so that's sort of what it reminded me of. I was like, we would not have been able to make it through that first dance. We would have had to be, we would have been escorted out of that.
Yes, mom would have turned us around, pushed us, turned us around, and sent us out.
yes.
Originally, that first dance wasn't in the movie.
Oh.
It was just supposed to be a song comes on, and Megan gets exasperated by how corny the song is. And Lynn read that, and she said, I think there should be a dance. And so last minute, she had a choreographer friend come in and choreographed this whole big dance. It went on a lot longer than what they actually ended up showing in the movie. And if you have the DVD, you should check out
that's
the
awesome
scene.
And you can tell, you could see that this was a longer piece. And one of the things I really like about, whatever combination this is of Andrea Siegel's script and Lynn Shelton's directing, the number of times the movie would move on in the middle of what in a different kind of comedy would be a big joke. Right. Like it would be some kind of big set piece and things would be falling down and, all kinds of crazy stuff would be happening. And in this movie, it's just this is part of life. Right. So we just catch this little glimpse of life and then we cut out of it. And so I'm still sort of have that residual. Oh, I was only half done laughing at that as we moved on to the next part, which is actually, if you sort of are go with the pace of the movie, I think is very sort of delightful.
Yeah. I really like that she knows not to stay too long in a scene. And it never keeps everything feeling fresh. You never feel like you're in a moment longer than you're supposed to be.
That's how I live my life. Before we get too much further into what happens, I wanted to talk about the dad real quick, Jeff Garlin, who on the whole, I'm not a giant fan, but in this, I really liked him, and my note for him is he's so helpful and so not helpful at the same time. like so supportive, but in such a way that she says gloating a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have words for it at this stage in the film, but she's floating and he's just, look at your beautiful, amazing floating self.
Yeah. He enables it. He's enabling
her. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I sort of love his unadulterated love for her, and whatever she does is amazing.
Yeah.
And yet that not only is sort of not helpful to her in this, at this stage, but also immediately then builds in, I think, empathy for the mother, who's the heavy to say,
right,
no, get get out of my house. You know,
like, what? Yeah, playing the bad cop.
Yeah.
Yeah, because she has to, right? Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Someone's got to point out that this person is an adult.
Yes.
But in any case, I just wanted to make sure that we had dad in the picture, because then I think seeing him cheat on the mom at the wedding reception is part of, you know, one of the straws that then gets right. her to leave. She can't even anymore and leaves the whole thing and meets new friends.
Yeah. I feel like Jeff Garland made a lot out of a small role, mm-hmm. and that his character could very easily be easy to hate. And I didn't hate him. I was actually amazed kind of that I didn't hate him, because I felt like, you know, if you look at him objectively on paper, you'd say this guy, he enables his daughter, even though, you know, he loves her. He's doing it out of love, but still, he's not helping her at all. He's not giving her good advice. He's cheating on his wife. He gets caught, and he says he doesn't have a good excuse.
Yeah.
And not that I think there is a good excuse for that necessarily, but, you know, not judging him, but his response is not great when she calls him out on it. And I thought it was interesting that they included that sort of subplot at all in the story, because you could, I think, make the movie without it.
Yeah, I think you could, but I think it really helps in her trying to decide what she wants, like what a relationship should look like and what she wants and where she wants to be. You know, I feel like, I don't know, seeing the sort of cracking of her parents' relationship while her friends are getting married, I think that it just all adds to that stew.
It demonstrates the consequences of a bad decision at this point in her life. Mm-hmm. And the idea that if she makes sort of the wrong choice for herself vis-a-vis her relationships of all kinds at this moment, it's going to, you know, there are potential repercussions, good or bad. You know, it's just like, it's all going to get messy. So let's make the best choice now that we could. That's how I read it anyway, is that sort of this is where various paths could lead, you know, which is not to say that like you make a bad choice and you're going to cheat on a spouse or whatever. But I mean, you know, they're, in terms of the movie logic, I think we're supposed to feel it that way a little bit. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Keira Knightley, so as we've alluded to, she's a big star for a Lynn Shelton movie. Lynn Shelton makes generally these very tiny movies and usually without, you know, like giant headlining cover magazine type stars. Corey, what did you think of Keira Knightley in this lead role?
I read an interview where she said that she's never played a character this floppy before. And I thought that was just a perfect description for the character and for the way that Keira played her. I had this is, I think, the first time she played an American character. So the first time I saw this, it took me a moment to adjust to her voice and the accent. But it never bothered me at all. And I really liked that this was like in a period of time when she was first starting to move away from all the period pieces.
Mm.
She had started out doing Bend It Like Beckham, but then she, I mean, Pirates of the Caribbean is kind of a costume drama in a weird way.
She did a lot of corset work. A lot of corset work.
Pride and Prejudice and Anna Karenina and The Duchess. And this was one of the first roles when she did, when she stepped out of that. And she did this and Seeking a Friend for the End of the World and Begin Again and a couple others. And before sort of going back to the period pieces. And so this was kind of a side of her that I don't think people had necessarily seen. And I think we forget that she can be really funny. That she can be really loose and just naturally kind of has a very easy way of holding herself. And I think that that definitely helped in playing this character.
Aizen, what'd you think?
I think, yeah, floppy is a great description for it. Because she was just, I know that her job was holding the sign outside the accounting agency, but she felt very much to me like one of those promotional things that it's like an windsock.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Right.
So I was like, oh, wrong prop.
And then when she shows up at her parents' house and just lets herself in and rolls over on the couch, she just rolls over the back of the couch and plops onto the sofa and grabs the remote. And just so naturally and so fluidly, you can tell that she's been doing this her entire life.
Yeah, her physical work in this movie, I think, is really good. And I you know, she's an actor that I sort of forget how much I like her until I see her working with a good director. You know, there's a certain amount of Keira Knightliness that sort of hangs around some of her roles. Like, they don't always feel like she's in the movie. And then she works with a good director, and I am on board. And I thought she was very good. I think Luce is a great description. I can see why she would want to do this movie, both in terms of it being contemporary and also getting to sort of, you know, show another side of herself.
Yeah. So I'd say that, you know, the other female lead is Chloe Grace Moretz, or Moretz, I don't know. And I do have some feelings. I get a weird, I'm shrugging my shoulders right now, like, you know, when your shoulders hurt and you have to
shrug them.
I have a reaction to precocious child actors, a la Dakota Fanning.
Oh, interesting.
In that sort of like, I'm an old soul. You know, that I don't know. And maybe it's because I have watched too many chat shows where they're set up to be that way and to be precocious. So I used to get that vibe from her, or I guess sometimes I get, or I've gotten that vibe from her. For instance, her whole 30 Rock thing, just her, maybe her being Alec Baldwin's nemesis, and the idea of it, I liked. I just couldn't watch her. She just made me too uncomfortable. That being said, I think she was great in this. So this is my maybe in the way to when you said sometimes you have a Keira Knightley of it all, and this was different than that. I sort of have a Chloe of it all, and this for me was, I liked her in this better. And I don't think any of it is because she's not a good actor. I think she's a great actor. I just think, you know, everyone has taste, and she's not always mine. But matter of factness of the character, you know, it takes something to walk up to a stranger and tell them of obviously, you know, terrible story to get them to buy you beer, or then asking that same almost stranger to take you to visit your mom. I mean, there's just kind of a, what comes across her path she deals with, and takes advantage of, but you know, what's a better phrase than takes advantage of? But you know what I'm trying to say? Like,
she
seizes opportunities
in
a way that Megan character seems to be unable to do at this point. So I think
that's so smart. That's so smart. Yeah. I see that. Yeah.
They're a good match that way. And interesting to watch. And I believed their attraction to each other just as people. And so I think that could have been, because it is awkward and uncomfortable. Like, why is this grown woman hanging out with these teenagers? I think the performances have to be there in order for it not to just be like, ew, that's weird. Yeah. Stop doing that. And while there are certainly moments of that, there's something there between them that I think works really well. And I'd like to give Chloe some credit for that. What, Corey, what do you think of Chloe in the performance?
I thought she was great. I thought she did a great job of playing the sort of self-absorbed teenager in a way that I didn't hate, because every one of her problems seemed really real, and how dramatic she would get over them made sense to me, given everything that we saw her go through and everything that she's, you know, talks about in her past. But I also get the impression from the way it's written that she sort of opens up to Megan in a way that she hasn't necessarily before. And in order to believe that, you know, that she had never before even considered thinking maybe I could go visit my mom, who I haven't seen since I was 9, or, you know, getting up the courage to have a conversation with the guy that she thinks she might be in love with. You get the impression that she isn't normally the person to just do all of these things, but that Megan is bringing that out in her somehow. And I think that if they didn't have such good chemistry on as both as characters and as actors, then that would not have come off.
Tobin, do you have Chloe thoughts?
I have always liked her a lot more than you have, I think. I don't mind the sort of preternaturally old child actor kind of thing. I do know what you mean, though. Sometimes, though, it does feel a little bit like shtick. And I think it probably has more to do maybe with the kind of parts and the directors people are working with. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. But I understand the syndrome you're talking about. I've always kind of liked her more. And I've never seen Kick-Ass, so I don't. That which is where the role that kind of introduced her, as I remember, in a kind of big way. So I didn't ever have that sort of experience of her. I think we can all probably agree, though, that Sam Rockwell is fantastic.
Yes, I was just going to say, speaking of chemistry, Sam Rockwell oozes something that I am just there for every time. And I was just having a conversation about it because I just watched 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
And my and my problem with Sam Rockwell is that I find him unnaturally charming. And yet there's so many of his movies that I'm not interested in seeing or that I shouldn't see. So maybe that's not true. Maybe I'm just seeing a particular sliver of his catalog. But I kind of can't get enough. And yeah, I love him. And I wrote down one of his first lines is, wow, high school students are looking rougher and rougher. I can't believe it. It's so good. I love him.
Talking about the mixer?
Yeah. Oh. These things, women insist on touching your forearm in this very deliberate manner. These touches are meant to communicate Gold Star level skills in listening and connectedness. Yeah. Do you know about this kind of gesture?
Yeah, you mean this one?
Yes. Do go on.
Do go on.
Right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Dad, you do know you can't lecture her all night, right? She's not a kid.
Oh, really? You stuck your friend into my house. I think you're lacking say-so here. If you let her spend the night in your locker, no, that's school's property.
And I don't know what he's like as a human necessarily. So I don't, you know, I don't want to put all my eggs in the Rockwell basket, but gosh, he's charming to watch.
I've seen a lot of interviews with him and he's just as charming as a regular human as well, it seems. One of the reasons I saw this actually, in addition to having heard that it was great at Sundance, is that I was still riding my Sam Rockwell obsession from The Way, Way Back coming out a year previously.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I was still in the swing of being Sam Rockwell was a revelation in this. So the moment I saw he had something else coming out, I knew I had to go see it.
And do you also enjoy the movie I can't think of the name of with Anna Kendrick and him? What's it called?
I didn't enjoy the movie, but I enjoyed him in it.
Because that's off brand for me because it's much more violent than I would like to watch a movie of. But I have watched it and I have shown it to people. I love it. I can't even. So Megan asks, you know, to crash at Annika's house for a week.
Yep.
Totally normal.
And that sort of they make that deal after Megan pretends to be Annika's mother at a high school counseling session. And totally normal. Also, that's when we learn that the turtle's name is Lynn.
Yes.
Just a little shout out.
Yep.
You know.
And the turtle was
Lynn before. Right.
Oh, really?
Signed on to direct, and originally the turtle was a dog.
Interesting. So there was a dog named Lynn that they turned into a turtle.
Yes, because Lynn Shelton was told they didn't have the budget to get a dog. And so she went to Andrea Siegel and said, we can't get a dog. But I used to have pet tortoises as a kid. Can you make it a tortoise? And she said, sure, and came up with the whole anorexic tortoise thing and really played it up.
Yeah, I think it's much more thematically appropriate, too, given the idea of the tortoise moving so slow and all that. And, you know, I think that I think it works a lot better as a and it's more interesting, too.
It also fits their household.
Yes.
They're not a dog household. A little bit offbeat.
Yeah. And also it feels like a dog might be too much companionship for Sam Rockwell's character in the, you know, like part of his thing is he's got
to
be kind of.
He has to be lonely.
Yeah. Sad sack and lonely. And I think that's the dog would. Well, I guess it could have been a dog that didn't like you very much, which could have been funny, too. But I do like the tortoise. I think it's a good touch.
It's in that first night. After they go to the high school party and they unsuccessfully sneak Meg back in to the house that, you know, Sam Rockwell calls her down to be like, what's actually going on? That she sort of, it all kind of falls out of her. We know some of the pieces from watching her interact with Anthony and with her family and things, but for her to really explain kind of where this crisis is coming from. And I wrote down, I absolutely empathize with, you know, this losing steam for this goal that she thought she had and that, but also no, like, that doesn't explain why you're in this young girl's house. I don't know, but I appreciated hearing from her and her being confronted, you know, sort of finally, about what's happening.
I thought it was really interesting to hear her trying to be honest, because you could tell she wasn't trying to, I mean, she was lying about about why she was trying to stay with them, but she was trying to be honest with herself about what got her to this point. Mm-hmm. And to hear just the little details about how, you know, she and her four friends in high school, but they, dance to the BC Boys instead of the Top 40, that told me so much about her that she felt that was a relevant detail to bring up and that she needed to say that in order to explain how she got to where she is, because it doesn't make any sense. But I can see, you could see her brain kind of working at the time thinking, okay, how, I don't really know how I got to where I am right now, how I got to this point where I am realizing that what I thought adulthood and relationships and friendships would look like, it doesn't look like that at all. But I am going to talk about who I was in high school.
Which also seems like the identity that she still feels most comfortable with. Their scenes together, I think, are just kind of sparkle. I think that they're, and I credit a lot of it to Sam Rockwell, who has this kind of, you know, like he plays it very, very real. And yet he's, as we've been saying, he's pointing out how sort of kind of strange the premise of the movie is, which is refreshing. And it makes it sort of, it makes it go down a little bit easier. And there are a few places in the movie where it feels like we shorthand through, like there's a one day after after Meg has moved in, where they kind of both are there for the day. He's not going to leave her alone in the house, so he's going to work from home, and she's kind of there at the house too. And I was worried in that kind of montage we get of their day that this was like they were going to like fall in love by the end of the day, and like the movie was going to go in a more obvious direction. And luckily it didn't. Like it avoids that at almost every turn. But there were times when my stomach would start to drop a little bit, and think, oh, this is going to go more conventional, isn't it? And then it doesn't. I do wonder a little bit whether it being more conventional might have made it more successful. you know, I mean, commercially. But I'm glad as a movie that it didn't do that.
Yeah, I feel like Sam Rockwell is so, I don't want to say brilliant, but I feel like we're just, it's gone from the Chris Pine appreciation show to the Sam Rockwell appreciation show, but
yes.
I'm here for both of those.
There you go. That he's pointing out the absurdity of the premise, but is also along for the ride.
Yeah.
And I like that about him, but I did put for that day montage day, strange flirting. And I don't know if how much that was supposed to be, or it is their chemistry, because he just, is a master of chemistry. I mean, he is a chemist, if you will. And so some of that could just be what it's like to be in a room with him. That does bring us, I'm sorry, to a thing that annoys me like crazy when the wardrobe lets me know that they changed things around. So that she's wearing a white t-shirt that day, then it's the next day and she's saying, have a good day at work, everybody. And then she's in the white t-shirt again, talking to Anthony. And then she's in the denim dress next time we see Chloe and they go visit the mom. So I'm sorry, it's nitpicky, but it irritates me.
The wardrobe is so on the nose. It's very, it's a very, very obvious visual motif. There's no subtlety to it, to the way that Ellie Kemper and her other friends from high school are always wearing those super bright and bold dual tone colors. And I know that they did this intentionally to show, oh, you know, they're in a different place and this is how they feel about their lives and where they are right now versus where Megan feels like she is, literally wearing a like slumpy white t-shirt and weird white pants. Strangest outfit to go to a bachelorette party in. I didn't need those visual cues in the wardrobe to get that.
Right. No, that, and when I wasn't even thinking about that, I was just thinking about the continuity of it. Mm. But because that's the part that got me, but I'm absolutely right that it demonstrates the distance again between this group that were all on the same page at some point and now are not. And also sort of the energy that she has to, you know, figure out what to wear. You know what I mean? Like it's that, no, I'll just throw this on. And that's perfectly fine. But I think if she used to be more in line with what her other friends were, this is a departure from that. And in some cases, wearing the high schooler's clothes. Which also made me uncomfortable. And then the other wardrobe thing that I think Tobin speaks a little bit to your comment about whether, you know, when it sort of takes a right turn from what the conventional story would be.
Yeah.
That they visit the estranged mom who doesn't have a good answer, you know, or about leaving and all that. But goes and gets all her comped lingerie.
Yes.
And offering that to her 15-year-old daughter. And it just, again, in this pool that we've already built that is so inappropriate, it makes sense, right? But if you took that out and I just awkward. Read the scene, I'd be like, what? Why on earth is she trying to give her lingerie? That's so, but it like fits.
Yes. Gretchen Mol plays that character. And I think she did such a fantastic job because even though she doesn't give any good reason at all for why she abandoned her family, I think that for Megan to meet her, that was really important for her to see an adult living with the consequence of choices that she made a long time ago. And with an adult who's living a life completely different from the one her friends are trying to construct for themselves. It's allowing her to see that there are other ways that she can end up, and they're not all good.
Yeah, no, that's a interesting way to demonstrate that to her.
Mm-hmm. I also am always really happy to see Gretchen Mol show up in things. She was an actress that was in, you know, a number of indie movies in the, I guess, was it maybe the 2000s or the late 90s that I grew to enjoy her presence quite a bit. And then it has come out since that she was a victim of some of the sort of Weinstein stuff in terms of, you know, curtailing her career in ways. I actually saw her most on stage when we were, when I was in New York. Her movie career never quite felt like she went where she was supposed to go. Do you know what I mean? Like wasn't
absolutely.
Sort of. I love to see her getting a chance to sort of, as you say, in a tiny scene or a couple scenes, have a little bit more of a substantial role or make more of a substantial role out of just a few scenes.
Yeah, and she has a strong presence, as she did when I first saw her in Rounders.
Sure.
Shout out to my good buddy Sean, also a big Rounders fan. While we're talking about the different choices she can make and what, you know, this, I feel like there's this kind of pushing against the idea of what she's supposed to do based on what her friends have done. And that on the way back from seeing the mom, they stop for a coffee treats and she runs into Allison accidentally when she's supposed to be at this other place at this seminar doing this, all this self work. And that Allison's argument is that she needs to follow the plan so that their stories make sense to each other.
Yes. Yes.
It's just so, and like, again, I empathize. Like I get that. And yet no, you know, and so I feel for Allison because I don't think she's, you know, like you said, Corey, and like Kimber said, she's not malicious. She's not, you know, and she's not even trying to get out of this friendship. She's, from her perspective, trying to keep it all together. And that involves following this very specific plan. And I just, you know, I don't know, would love some time to talk to Allison about how it's all a social construction. And there's no need to. You can just explain the stories a little more if someone isn't on the same page. But I thought that was a really, it was a moment that even though I'd seen the movie before, I sort of caught my breath a little bit, like, oh no. And even though I'm not necessarily rooting for Keira Knightley's character, I still was like, oh, you know, dang it. Here are the cops. Like,
yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And then she goes on a date with Sam Rockwell.
I think we all go on a date with Sam Rockwell.
I know. Right. Not a fan of just grabbing someone and kissing them. I'm just going to say that.
He makes it look like something you would want. And I'm like, well, that's kind of a problem. But also, I understand.
The way I read that scene, and again, not to, you know, encourage or excuse any kind of behavior, but the way I read that scene is he's working up the nerve, and it felt a little, and this may be just the way he's playing it to try and make it for himself be less inappropriate, but that there's a certain amount of, he's like, I got to take my chance now, I got to do it. And he just sort of, you know, goes for it. Again, not as an excuse or as condoning the behavior at all. But it feels like it comes from a place of his character that doesn't feel malicious on his part.
Right. And it is a consensual activity. I just, you know, I like to point out, it's not the model by which to take notes and say, this is how to approach someone. I also did just love when she said, let's not finger bang in the street.
She says, oh my God. She says, maybe we don't finger bang on the street. Yeah. It's just so well delivered. It's so good. It's so good.
Which also I think speaks to her delayed, or not delayed, but just in a different place than the, you know, her friends that we've met that probably are, that's not the vernacular that folks are using anymore. Yeah. You know, I don't think Allison has probably said finger bang that prom night. Right, and so it was just sort of there's a freedom in this weird limbo of I'm with these high school kids, but I'm not. But I, you know, I mean, I can, mm-hmm. She's comfortable there. And because Annika is having a sleepover with her friend Misty, who I have to say also standout performance. Yeah. I thought Misty was great.
She's fantastic. She steals every scene that she's in.
Yeah, she's good. Can we give her a ding real quick?
Let me get it. Yeah. Let's find her name.
It's Caitlin Daver.
Caitlin Daver.
Yeah. Thank you. Nice ding.
Thanks.
And she's the one who says leggies.
Yes. She's the one who brings the title into the world.
I watched in the making of, because we do need to talk a little bit about the title, because I watched the making of on the DVD, and they talk about how the movie went through a variety of titles before they
settled on Laggies as the title, and that it came up rather late in the process of the development of the story. And I wonder if they then added the line to the movie to sort of at least make it make sense. I don't think this is a good title for this movie.
Agreed.
I think that not only does it, can Aslan not say it, but it feels a little bit like the problem that the Hudsucker Proxy has. We maybe have talked about this on other episodes, which was a great Coen Brothers movie with a title nobody could really, it was sort of an inscrutable title. And I feel like this movie is so much less inscrutable than the title war than this title sort of implies. And while sure, I think, I guess it can make sense like on paper, I just think it's not a, and I know they didn't want something generic and I appreciate that. I just don't think it's a very good title.
I don't either, but I do think it's funny. The screenwriter Andrew Siegel thought that it was a common word, a common slang word that everybody knew.
Oh, really?
And yes. She thought that everybody knew what laggies meant and that everybody called their friends laggies when they were like being slow or running late or something, and tried convincing Lynn Shelton that she was crazy for not knowing what it meant.
Oh, wow.
And then once Lynn Shelton started talking to other people, it quickly became clear to her that that Andrea and her friends were the only ones who ever used this word.
Which then, you know, it was probably cute and fun and interesting on set, but then didn't translate back out.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right.
No. And as a you know, conclusion, it should not be the name of the film.
That's right. Right.
If it was a word that was common, if it was a word that people used, I can see how it would make sense. Mm-hmm. As a description of Megan,
yes,
who feels right. Like, who seems like she's the laggy. She's the one who's lagging behind all of her friends on this road to what they think adulthood looks like.
Right.
But since nobody knows what the word means, it's not a thing. It's like trying to make fetch happen.
Yep. Yeah. Right. right. Yeah. Are we ready to talk about the sort of conclusion of the movie? Because I have thoughts about the conclusion of the movie.
I have. Yes. Well, before that.
Okay. Yep. I knew it.
I have some concerns. I don't know. I mean, this is not unique to this film, but on this watching, I was constantly irritated by they're all just white people with money. and heteronormative, and you know, and again, so many, this is not this particular film's fault, but it was just hard over and over again. I think Corey, you made a comment earlier about you know, Chloe's problems and that her being you know, self-absorbed like a teenager, and I agree, but all of their problems, you know, none of the problems really had a weight for me because they were just so, it didn't have guts is what I don't, that's not what I wanted to say, but I kept thinking, what would change this if they were, you know, working class or working poor? What would change this if, Megan was a person of color, or the family were folks of color, or, you know, I wanted something more in the story to give the story, for me, sort of consequence and staying power.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. That's a problem that I have with pretty much most movies that are especially particularly coming of age movies, particularly if it happens to be one of the rare coming of age movies about a woman.
So that's the thing. Like, if we get, and I don't want to go past where we are. I do want to talk about the end before we, you know, pass full judgment, but that absolutely having, you know, the story is about a young woman, young women, really. And there are, you know, far fewer stories told, you know, centered that way. But what did this one add? kind of to that for me. And I will get when we get to the very end, because I can make my, you know, I can make it work different ways, but they were exemplifying the invisibility, in, you know, in their lives, mm-hmm. of it, yeah. Which is not, this is not, I mean, she's the man, absolutely right. guilty of it, at least as much, if not more, and in more egregious ways. Mm-hmm. This is not the first film we're talking about that has that, and we know that, you know, representation is so important, and you know, they're just.
Maybe it's that the rest of the movie feels so it allows itself to be so idiosyncratic and so sort of against the normal type of this kind of movie that it glares more that this follows that the form of so many of, as you say, coming of age stories, this kind of milieu, like this socially, like this, it maybe it stands out more because the movie feels smarter about other things.
Mm. Oh yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
All through the last part of my notes are these big capital letters saying, if she gets married to this guy, goes back to her fiance and gets married to him, I'm going to flush this movie. Like, it really had me. I thought that, oh my God, is this movie really going to end up with her going off and getting married to this guy who's, it's just clearly not the right choice for her? Like, is that the lesson that she's supposed to learn? Or at least.
And not the right choice for him.
Well, right.
I feel, you know, most concerned about Anthony, and Anthony needs to be able to move forward with someone who's excited to be with him.
Yeah.
I think I absolutely believe that she loves him.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
But she's not excited.
Like the breakup scene, which is kind of cool, then, right? The breakup scene happens at the airport as they're about to get on this flight to go to Las Vegas to elope. And mm-hmm. and they call their gate, and he takes this picture mm-hmm. and sends it to their friends, and she realizes in that moment that's the sort of straw that breaks the camel's back for her. She's like, okay, this isn't gonna work. And mm-hmm. and so we have the, instead of the sort of race to the, you know, airport to wrap up the you know, the romantic comedy and sort of save the relationship, she decides this is the point at which I have to call it, because it's just not going to, I can see now it's not going to work. So I do like that they sort of invert that and that they had me up to that point. And then I think that scene between them is very good. It feels, I feel her pain in having to hurt him and his mm-hmm. pain in not understanding how, like he just had read this whole situation completely wrong for a long time with her, you know? Mm-hmm. And that, like, and they do a smart thing in not having like a big blow up fight. Because in my experience, in those moments, like it's going to take a while for him to sort of absorb what is going to feel like a betrayal to him of however many however long in the relationship it's been that she's kind of been out of it. And so they don't have to do the whole scene here. Right. Like they just do this part of it. I think that's very smart.
But then they ruin it.
I know.
I was so angry because I did not remember. I remembered her breaking up with him at the airport. And because the part that sticks out to me is her saying, I'm finally doing this, which I think that's what's going to make him mad later when he processes it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, finally, for how long have you felt this way and not told me? Yeah. But then she drops off the box of wine and the little sixth grade note. And fine, had she done that, but the note would be different. If it were me in charge of this, she would have dropped off the box of wine with an apology letter that then, you know, says, I'm going to take some time. I'm going to figure my shit out. You know, here's my information in the future or something. Right.
Yep.
But that she's standing there waiting.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, it made me mad. Corey, you're a big fan of this movie. How does the end sit for you?
It doesn't necessarily sit well, but it's usually something that I am willing to look past. because I usually, by the time I get to the end, I am the airport scene is so good. The breakup scene is really emotional, and they do such a good job at really making you feel for both of the characters. And they do a great job throughout the whole film and making you think, you know, is she really going to stay with this guy? because he's just likable enough to make you think, okay, I don't want her to just dump him, but also she shouldn't stay with him, and they make it this real dilemma. And so it does, that's such a nice ending. And then the scene where she goes to the kids' prom and, you know, pep talks Annika and tells her she's not going to need to know about shapes with more than 8 fucking sides later in life, or parabolas, because math is useless later in life. Like, that's such a great scene also. It's usually the kind of thing where, like, when you get to that last scene, it's just kind of anticlimactic. And also, it's the ending that you're supposed to want at this point. But
yeah,
I don't, by the time we get to it, I kind of don't want it anymore.
It demonstrated for me how much work she still has to do. Like, that was not the, I'm going to put my life back together choice.
No.
Right.
That was the, I met this guy and we got drunk and fooled around and now I'm in love with him.
Yeah.
And like, maybe he is the love of her life, but like, that's not, she's no good to him right now.
No.
Yeah.
Because she's got to figure it out.
Exactly. Our mom is going to love the ending of the movie, the way it works. Like,
because it's a happy ending.
It's a happy ending. Hi, Mom. And I'm glad for you that the movie has this ending. I wish if they were going to have this, the ending as it sort of, as here's where I cut it. She drops off the box of wine. You know, he's in the house, gets the doorbell rings. He goes or knocks or whatever. He goes there. There's the box of wine. There's the note. And then he shuts the door.
Yeah.
Or like she shows up, then he shuts the door. Like, that's where I'd end the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because she's not, she has not, you to jump she from one relationship it. Into the next. Yeah. It just doesn't feel like the right, she's just not ready, right? Yeah. I mean, come on. She needs to go find herself. And I hate to sort of prescribe for someone else because who knows what she really needs. But I found it to be a sort of cop out in terms of the.
I agree. That
for so long has been so smart about the emotional reality of this point in this person's life and what they're going through. And she's going to solve it all by going and hooking up with Sam. I mean, it's Sam Rockwell. So I do get it. But like, it felt lazy to me.
But here's another solution, because I don't want to. Tell her she can't go get hers.
Right,
so what if the note says, want to help me rebound? Or something to make it clear. Because that's where they're at, right? But that she's fallen in love with him. I don't believe it. It not ruins the whole thing. But I had wondered when I put it on the list, I thought to myself, wait, why don't I own this? Because I did seek it out and I had remembered enjoying it. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And I think this is why, because I get to the end and I'm mad.
You should do like what Mom does with is it Something's Gotta Give that she shuts off when
that the one with Keanu?
Yeah, which is with Keanu Reeves. Like, that's where my mom turns off that movie. Because that's the ending of the movie that she likes. That's what you should do with this, Aizen. You should do your fan edit and just like cut the turn off the movie.
I stop reading Little Women in a certain spot each time. In any case, while there's some whimsy around, would you like to play a game?
Yeah.
Yes, let's play a game.
So you said it in your synopsis, and this is a quarter-life crisis movie, right?
That's what I said. Yep.
That's what you said. And this is not the first. According to Wikipedia.
Yeah. Always right. Yep.
They sort of credit The Graduate.
Oh,
as
sure.
The first core life crisis.
Interesting.
And you know, they're everywhere. And I'm not going to give their whole list. People can look it up, but it's also, and this is not the conversation we're having, but it's a whole lot of movies about white people. But again, there may be many categories in which you can, you know, say that. But I just, it's like, this might be a very specific phenomenon.
Right.
I want you all to tell me, I want you to pick a quarter-life co-pilot. So who from either this film or another film that we have done on the Contenders podcast. Who would you want to be your wing person to help you navigate through what this film and other films are telling us is an inevitable life explosion that we all have at the end of our 20s?
All right.
And just as a reminder, our films include The Contender, Wonder Woman, Lady Bird, She's the Man, A Wrinkle in Time, Aliens, Zero Dark Thirty, Hidden Figures, Twilight, Winter's Bone, Revenge, Ocean's 8, and The Leveling.
Mm.
Wow. Okay.
All right. Let's say this. Is there a leading lady character from any of those? Who would be your quarter life co-pilot and why?
Oh, so now let me ask this. Do you mean someone who's moving through it at the same stage with me, or is like a mentor type figure? Like
whatever you need in a co-pilot through this journey. Okay.
All right. I have some ideas. Shall I go first?
Sure.
Yes, please.
Okay. So my first idea was maybe the Jessica Chastain character of Zero Dark Thirty. Mm. Just because she seems to like she has a purpose. Like she knows, maybe sort of, and she would have no patience for a quarter life crisis, it feels like. But also that no patience might be difficult for me at a quarter life crisis. So that then maybe felt like too much. So I think I'm going to go with, I would like to have as my sort of mentor co-pilot through it, the Reese Witherspoon character from A Wrinkle in Time.
Nice.
Mm.
That's a good one.
I think would be kind, but funny, and also, but like confused by why I was, you know, she could sort of mm-hmm. talk sense into me by not understanding what the hell I was doing.
Yeah, she would tell you this is a very privileged phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. And that might in a more gentle way than the Jessica Chastain character might sort of, you know, shake me out of it.
I think I would agree about Reese Witherspoon if I was looking for someone to be kind of more outside of it and more mm-hmm. of a mentor figure, who someone who is the one pushing me to be like, okay, you're going to get out of this because, you know, your quarter life is going to end and you're going to get older and figure things out. You're going to make the small adjustments and you're going to go on your way. I think I would definitely want her because she also wouldn't hesitate to lose patience with me mm-hmm. when mm-hmm. appropriate. But if I wanted for someone I would want going through it with me, I would say either Lady Bird or Julie, because I feel like they wouldn't Ooh. Judge me for the whatever I was experiencing and whatever felt like the end of the world to me. Although that's one thing I was thinking at first, you know, well, why not Megan herself? Because she mm-hmm. clearly has made all of these terrible decisions, has gotten some perspective, and, you know, would it be a good person to stand next to going through with this? And then I kind of thought, you know, she was so quick in ways to judge at the beginning of the movie, and at the end, I don't know how much I think she's changed.
Interesting.
She says to her dad about, you know, I can't judge because I screwed up too, but I don't know if she considers her screw ups to be if she like can see them for what they really are, mm-hmm. kind of. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd rather just have someone that I can laugh with and go on the log flume ride with.
Yes. Someone to be in the trenches of a quarter life crisis with. Yeah.
Yes.
Aislinn, what about you?
So for my in the trenches person to commiserate with, I would pick Mindy Kaling from Ocean's 8.
Oh, good. Good one.
I think we have fun together, especially with all her money. The characters or Mindy, but, you know, traveling together and just sort of soaking it up. And then, I mean, I just Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it would be, I could literally pull me out of it with her invisible lasso. But also I think in the similar to y'all's Reese Witherspoon answer, her sort of, you know, that naivete.
Yeah.
Would, I think, also be helpful in mm-hmm. finding some perspective, which is definitely what all the people in this movie needed.
Yeah, perspective. That's a good word for it. Yeah.
So now comes the time when we give our sort of final review. Is this film progressive or regressive? Is it a step forward or a step back for fearless women in front of and behind the camera? Corey, you are our guest. You've seen this movie the most out of all of us. What say you?
I will say progressive because I just really love that a woman directed a movie by another woman about a pretty flawed and pretty unlikable female character, the kind of complex character that we get to see men play all the time, and wasn't afraid to let her be in many ways unsympathetic. She was kind of like Carrie Bradshaw to me in that she's kind of terrible and kind of annoying, but at the same time, it makes me feel better to see someone like her on screen.
Awesome. Tobin, what is your answer?
I came in conflicted about this because the movie, by the end of it, because of that last scene, makes it feel like so much of the movie's been based on the character's issues with men, and that it still revolves around who she's with and what her dad is doing and which guy she should be with. But I am persuaded by Corey's analysis, and so I'm going to come down on the side of progressive for all the reasons that she said. Aislinn, what about you?
I agree with the strengths particularly thinking about the character as being unlikable and foibled and complex that we don't see enough of from people who aren't men. And I absolutely love that one woman wrote it, one woman directed it, many women produced it, and this is what we get. That being said, I can't make it get to the progressive side for me. I'm gonna put it right in the middle and leave it floating. Get it? in that it's neither. I don't know that it's regressive for this issue. But I, other than the sheer fact of it getting made, which I know is huge, there it doesn't add to the world for me. I'm reminded of a comment Tobin made in when we were talking about revenge, saying, do we need another violence, revenge, fantasy kind of thing? I don't know, but if we do, it's this one. I think this is a fine movie, but I don't think it moves the needle forward. So I'm going to come down say neither. Which I've never That's said fair. Before. So I'm excited about that.
Well, you said on Twilight, right?
No. Is that a joke? Like that I wasn't sure. Yeah. All right. Awesome. Tobin, what do we have coming up next?
Next, we are going to watch the Paul Feig movie Spy coming. We're going to drop that in 2 weeks on August 7th. So if you haven't seen Spy or haven't seen it recently, treat yourself. Watch a little Spy and come check it out on August 7th. Oh, man, this has been so much fun. Thanks for joining our podcast and chatting with us, Corey.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us where people can find you if you want to be found online.
Where I can be found online. I can be found on Twitter. My handle is at Quintessency, like the word quintessential, except with a Y. Generally on there complaining about the New York City MTA or about rude people in movie theaters. So that's about all I do on there. But, please feel free to stop by.
It's very entertaining. The other thing that we do is back and forth on Twitter is champion Paddington 2 as the best movie of this year.
Oh, you're a Paddington tour. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. My Twitter feed is pretty much just the MTA, people in movie theaters, and the campaign to get Hugh Grant an Oscar nomination for Paddington 2.
You're here. We are here for it. Aislinn, where can people find you or do you want to be found?
Oh my goodness. You can find me on Twitter at SassyNerdMT. though I'm still pretty disdainful of the medium. I also have a, now that my bio is up on the Cage Club website, I have an email through Cage Club, and just waiting for those creepy fan emails. So send them my way.
Careful what you wish for.
Tobin, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Tobin Addington, and you can find us at facebook.com/thecontenderspod or on Twitter at contenders_pod. Tell us what movies you want us to see. Tell us what movies you'd like to see us do in the future. We here at The Contenders are proud members of the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all those great shows, go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub, and you can find them at Cage Club Pod on Twitter.
You can find all the Cage Club Network shows on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Those reviews really help us spread the word. And if you leave us a comment that we like, we might even read it on an upcoming show. We're not reading one tonight because we've both kind of been taking a break from Twitter.
It's true.
And thus, it gives us a little more time to sift through the fan mail.
Yes, there's just so many. There's so many great reviews that we're having trouble picking. We don't want people to feel
bad. Absolutely. Yeah. This is just positivity only here. Thanks for joining us. I'm Aislinn Addington.
I'm Corey O'Connell.
I am Tobin Addington, and we'll see you next time on The Contenders.
Today we're talking about the 2014 I'm going to do that again.
Yeah, go for it.